Dr. Kaplan was born in South Africa, and in 1982 he relocated to England, where he went to study homeopathy at the Royal London Homeopathic Hospital. He graduated and then became a member of the faculty in 1983 and a fellow in 2002. In addition to his studies in homeopathy, Dr. Kaplan has also studied counseling, nutritional dietetics, fitness, yoga, autogenic training, and something called provocative therapy, which I hope he'll share a little bit about later. He's been an enthusiastic teacher of homeopathy since the late 1980s, and in 1991 he was made the co-founder of the Homeopathic Professionals Teaching Group, which continues to teach classical homeopathy to doctors, veterinarians, and nurses around the world. He's also a lecturer at the Royal London Homeopathic Hospital. In 1987, Dr. Kaplan co-edited with Dr. Marion Harling Gibson's Studies of the Homeopathic Remedies. And then in 2001, he published his book entitled The Homeopathic Conversation, which is one of the books that I highly recommend to all of my students, and I think is really one of the most important and central works written in homeopathy in the last 20 years. For me personally, it's just incredibly practical, useful wisdom on what is required to take a thorough and comprehensive case, and really that's kind of the fundamentals to being able to be successful in homeopathic practice. So thank you again for all of your contributions to homeopathy, and again for taking the time out to join us today.
Pleasure. Thank you for saying all those nice things about me.
Well, they're all very, very much true. So, like I said, thank you so much. And I guess I'll start, Brian, with your book, The Homeopathic Conversation. As I said a moment ago, for me personally, it's just a tremendous book. I recommend it to all of my students. I think it's one of the key components to being actually successful in homeopathic practice. And I'm curious, what originally led you to write the book?
Well, it goes back to the moment that I first got interested in homeopathy. And when I noticed a book that was called Homeopathy by a guy called Gordon Ross, and what struck me is that it was written by a medical doctor. Now, I'd heard about homeopathy, but I didn't know that actual medical doctors practiced it. So it was on a sale in a bookshop, and I, for the equivalent of probably a couple of dollars now, so I bought it. And he, in the book, he described homeopathy and what he did and how he treated people, but what fascinated me was how he spoke to his patients, what he needed to know from his patients in order to give a correct homeopathic prescription was revolutionary to me, because what he was saying was that what he was listening to was the subjective experience of an illness by the person, by the client or by the patient, whereas orthodox medicine was very objective. In other words, when you're talking to a person, many of the things they'll say you will just disregard because they don't fit what you want to know from a medical textbook. They don't help you diagnose congestive cardiac failure, for example, or asthma or whatever. It's just irrelevant. But here, what he was describing, and which I later found out very much is the essence of homeopathy, was that everything a patient says could be and often is very important. In other words, homeopathy, and to this day I believe this, shows the greatest respect for the patient's subjective experience of their life and their illness and their symptoms. The more we understand how they are experiencing their illness, the better chance we have of prescribing a homeopathic medicine. Hmm. Now, when I looked at the homeopathic literature, though, and I started to study homeopathy, the Organon, Kent, and all the famous books, there was very little written about this. If you look at Hahnemann, there's only a few paragraphs on taking the case. There's good advice in those paragraphs, some of which I agree and some of which I don't, like ask the patient to speak slowly. Don't agree with that, but many of the things I do agree with, for example, don't interrupt the patient, things like that. And Kent wrote a book called What the Doctor Needs to Know in Order to Make a Prescription. But it's just a list of information that you want to get out of the patient. So no one had really looked at this subject. And my interest in psychotherapy and counseling showed me that many people had taken interest in the subject, but not necessarily from a homeopathic point of view. So what I tried to do in the book was to give the reader the benefit of my studying of all these areas with a particular interest in what would be useful to the homeopath. And that book was the result of that.
Mm. I love the opening story that you tell at the beginning about the two different practitioners, one who is very well versed in the Organon and Materia Medica and the repertory, and the other who, although not well versed, knows how to take a good case. And the comparison that you make, and basically what you point out being that the one who, even though he doesn't have a lot of Materia Medica knowledge, if he knows how to take a good case, he's in a position to cure the patient. And I think that's just a really brilliant little opening to your book.
Oh, thank you. I mean, this is, you see, this is what I think that sometimes the homeopathic education goes wrong. You see, we sometimes think, well, we've got to teach the students some Materia Medica and first aid and the basic remedies, calcarea carbonica, sulfur, thuja, whatever, and they need to understand this stuff. But perhaps not. Perhaps a course, if I had to design a course in homeopathy now, I would teach in the first year the Organon. That's, you know, very crucial, and there's still some very, very important stuff in them. I'm not saying there isn't some stuff that hasn't that's dated, but there has. Some of it's dated, but there's some wonderful stuff in there as well. So to get to grips with the origins of homeopathy, some history of homeopathy, what happened, the different voices that emerge in homeopathy after Heinemann, and I would teach them to take the case and talk to a patient and take the case and leave the Materia Medica. The study of Materia Medica is a slow, lifelong process, and to try to rush it is just ridiculous, because you're just reading words, and you read one remedy and you read another, and you don't have a feeling of it. You haven't met a patient. You haven't seen someone respond to that remedy. So that would be quite revolutionary to teach homeopathy in that way. But that's
And Brian, this is the way that you see being taught largely today, where people are simply not focusing on these basic elements and right into the Materia Medica.
I'm not, you know, in the know in the different colleges, so I wouldn't want to make a sweeping statement like that.
Yeah.
But it seems they rush to the remedies. If I look at the seminars, the international seminars that are being presented now, it seems to me a lot of them are very focused on very small segments of remedies, like we're going to talk about this small group of remedies. I won't give example. I don't want to single anyone out, but let's look at this group of remedies and that group of remedies and these new remedies. And I really don't think that's what homeopathy is all about.
Mm-hmm. I hear you. Well, Brian, I'm curious. There have been a lot of developments in homeopathy the last few years. Do you see any as being particularly important?
I don't think there's been such a lot of developments, actually. I think... If I think back to 1982, March 1983, when I started studying homeopathy, that's, you know, more than 25 years, I think there has been one big contribution to homeopathy, and it's not clear who one can say that belongs to, because different authors have written about that. People like Massimo Mangialavori and Jan Scholten, both of them have looked at this. And to some extent, Rajan Sankaran as well. The idea that certain remedies, say, for example, laxatives, became, through default, an archetype of the snake remedies, which was a mistake. What someone like Massimo has said, someone who I have the utmost respect for as a homeopath, Massimo Mangialavori has said, is not that laxatives is the archetype of the snakes, it's just one of the snakes. So it's come to a point where those remedies, because they've been used over and over again ever since, that Lacus has appeared in the famous story about it, as we know, Herring's discovery of Lacus. Ever since then, it became the remedy that would be given for a snake when the patient called for a snake remedy. And the other snake remedies weren't used as much. So therefore, it became more and more used, and became more and more imprinted in the repertories and the Materia Medica, and everyone knew what Lacus is when they didn't know what Centurus was, for example. So people like Massimo have said, when you get and you think of giving Lacus, you should be looking at the other snakes, particularly the snakes whose venom produces a hemolytic type effect.
Mm.
And this you could also see within the work of Scholten. He would say, don't, if you think it's a natrum muriaticum case, don't just give natrum muriaticum, look at the other natrum remedies, look at the other muriaticum remedies. So this idea of themes or groups of remedies, and so don't rush to one just because it's been overemphasized, might have been overemphasized in the Materia Medica. Think a little bit laterally to all the snakes, to all the spiders, not just Tarantula hispanica has got to be, represents all the spiders. It may be the main one, but there are others. Others may be, lead to a more elegant prescription.
Mm. So, Brian, I'm just curious. So you, when you practice, you see qualities among these groupings that you're looking for, and that might be an indication for you to prescribe a snake or a spider or a solanaceae.
Well, just, I mean, no. I mean, just simply, really. If I, previously in 1983, if a patient came and the patient was jealous or had hot flushes and, you know, premenstrual tension, which immediately disappeared as soon as the menstruation started, and I would think, well, Lachesis or whatever. Now I would think, yeah, it looks like Lachesis, but maybe let me just think about the other snakes for a minute, the ones that I didn't study when in the 1980s. Let me just think about those, and sometimes I would give a different one. That to me, that idea of saying, yeah, this remedy represents the snake, or is one of the snakes, but there's a group, so I should be thinking of the group, not just of that remedy.
Sure.
And that I do think is progress in homeopathy.
Mm. Cool. You know, Brian, I know there have been a lot of attacks recently in the United Kingdom on homeopathy, and since you do live in the city of London, I'm curious what your opinion is as to why this is happening, what's going on there, anything you can tell us about the situation.
Okay. Now, this requires a little bit of me telling you a bit about the history.
Sure.
Because we know the history of what happened in America. Harris Coulter described this in immaculate detail. Okay. Now let's just have a look at the history in the United Kingdom. In the early 19th century, homeopathy was brought to England by a man called Frederick Foster Hervey Quin. And he was a high society.
Could you spell that last name for people so they can get the name?
Frederick Foster Hervey Quin. Q-U-I-N.
Okay, great.
One N, okay? So Quinn, whether he met Hahnemann or not, he was in Leipzig, and he definitely met Hahnemann's disciples, and may have met Hahnemann. We're not clear about this. But nevertheless, he came back to London. He was an aristocrat. He was friendly with the Prince of Wales at the time, and he quickly got homeopathy established here. And then he built the first London homeopathic hospital, which had a fantastic coup when it treated cholera much more successfully than other hospitals. Now, all this was happening in the 19th century, and several homeopathic hospitals were built in England in the 19th century. At least six homeopathic hospitals were built. Now, so all this carried on, and at that time, as we know, orthodox medicine was much worse than it is today. So homeopathy compared very, very favorably with orthodox medicine at that time. So there were these hospitals in London, Manchester, Liverpool, Glasgow, Tunbridge Wells, Bristol, maybe even one or two others. But now, in 1948, there was a momentous moment in the history of British medicine. This was the establishment of the National Health Service. And now, you have a situation where there's hundreds and hundreds of hospitals. All were persuaded to become part of the National Health Service. So at that time, the homeopathic hospitals run by doctors, there were only doctors doing homeopathy in those days. Professional homeopaths or non-doctor homeopaths are quite a new phenomenon. So those hospitals, in the spirit of the providing a National Health Service, a people's medicine service, opted and agreed to become part of the National Health Service. So they became homeopathic hospitals within the National Health Service, and there was a whole system, like any National Health Service hospital. In order to get treatment there, homeopathic treatment there, you need to be referred there by your general practitioner. So that carried on. And in 1961, it was even further, because there was some opposition to it. There's always been opposition to homeopathy. But in 1961, it was even sort of written deeper into the law, as it were, by a bylaw was specifically passed in Parliament saying the people of Britain are entitled to homeopathic medicine on the National Health Service. So this did make homeopathy's position in England quite unique compared to other places. But that wasn't just through benevolence. That was because these hospitals had been established. They had been established. So it was through the good work of those doctors like Quinn, who at the same time had befriended the Prince of Wales and became the royal physician, and there's been a royal homeopathic physician, and there's been a royal homeopathic physician ever since, in a very high status position within the medical circle attached to the royal family. So now in 1961 they've been established, but the attacks on homeopathy continue. And but the political system governing the health service goes through all sorts of phases, and homeopathy survives very nicely. Then, a couple of years ago, a bunch of consultants wrote to, it's very complex, but they call the commissioners the directors of commissioning, and these are people that determine what services, what health services are going to be provided in a large geographical area. There are about 300 of them. The countries divide into 300 of them. So what these eminent doctors, which I've described pretty much in detail on my blog, but I call them physicians of the utmost fame, quoting Hilaire Belloc, when he, in a poem written by Hilaire Belloc, he writes, "Physicians of the utmost fame were called at once, but when they came, they answered as they took their fees. There is no cure for this disease." And anyway, so this bunch wrote to these directors of commissioning. In other words, they wrote to a bureaucracy above the heads of the GPs a letter. And that letter said that homeopathy shouldn't be supplied, it's implausible, that trials don't show it work, a whole lot of stuff, which we can discuss. But what it did, it succeeded in preventing general practitioners from referring patients to homeopathic medical doctors on the National Health Service in quite a few areas, at least a third of these trusts. And that was a big blow. It led to the closure of one of these hospitals, which is a tragedy for homeopathy. Tunbridge Wells Hospital closed. Royal London Homeopathic Hospital has more or less survived, but it's under threat. And so what they could have written, which I've said would have been honest, would have been to write to doctors trying to dissuade them from referring patients to homeopathy. That is their right. But they didn't. They went above the doctor's head to thwart the wishes of orthodox doctors who would like their patients seen by homeopathic doctors. And that just really upset me, and I responded to that very strongly on my blog.
Unbelievable. So, Brian, who's responsible for these attacks? I mean, who's behind this whole thing?
You can see the names. If you look at my blog, you will see the names when I talk about this infamous letter, okay? And the infamous letter is this letter that was written to this bureaucrat. Just think of it as a bunch of bureaucrats that can actually control what services people in a geographical area of England get and whether the doctors want it or not. And so it's a bunch of doctors. One of them, Professor Michael Baum, I was debating about homeopathy about 15 years ago. I say, I mean, he's sort of been a bug in his system that he's always been anti-homeopathy for so many years. And well, there's a bunch of them, Ed Zotto, and they've openly signed this letter. It was an open letter. You can see it referenced on my blog, and you can see all 13 names. And as I said, I've called them also the disciples of scientism. And scientism, that's what I've called them. They don't like the title themselves, I'm sure. Scientism is an over-reliance on science. Unless something is scientific, it must be discarded. Now, here, what I'm going to say now is probably the most crucial thing that I will say in this interview. There's an issue called evidence-based medicine, okay? And they say that homeopathy does not have evidence behind it. It is not evidence-based. People like myself and Peter Fisher and others will say that homeopathy has some evidence. We like some of the evidence. We don't like others, etc. It's equivocal. It's not overwhelming evidence, but we think the evidence is generally positive. But they say that there's no evidence. What they are saying, though, or implying, is that the orthodox medicine, the whole of orthodox medicine, is evidence-based, which is entirely untrue. It is untrue. In fact, if we were to remove everything that is not evidence-based from medicine, if we were to say that the National Health Service should only supply evidence-based medicine, it is not homeopaths that would suffer the most. It was the drug companies that would be hit beyond belief by such a law, because most of orthodox medicine is not evidence-based. I've published a pie on the blog. It shows that 13% of orthodox medical interventions are based on solid evidence. 44% are likely to be of benefit. Okay, so that adds up to 57%. And the rest, 43%, qualify as being useless or worse than useless. In other words, they do damage to patients, which is something that homeopathy really, really does. So,
Brian, I'm just curious. You know, one thing that seems to be an anomaly to me, at least, is the fact that the Royal Family of England both uses and endorses homeopathic medicine, and yet there seems to be so many attacks in Great Britain against homeopathy. And I'm just curious, you know, doesn't the Royal Family have some type of political clout that they...
Well, they do, because, I mean, you think about it, the man in the street, say, he doesn't know much about medicine, and what are these doctors talking about trials? He just wants to get better, you know, he just wants to not have headaches on the weekends or whatever it is. And then he sees, oh, the Queen goes for homeopathic medicine. Well, you know, the Queen gets all her medicine free. She can choose any doctor in the country to treat her. So why would she choose homeopathy? And that's a very good question, you know. So he thinks, well, if it's good enough for the Queen, maybe it's good enough for me. But the Queen is very apolitical, as you know. She's never going to get involved in this sort of thing. Prince Charles, however, has. But he's been viciously attacked every time he opens his mouth and says something positive about homeopathy. And someone wrote it. They made a television program about him called The Meddling Prince.
Hmm.
So he's even toned down his what he actually says. But yes, they are in favor. They are friends of homeopathy.
Hmm. So, Brian, what future do you think do we have for homeopathy with these attacks?
It is a big one, you see, because a lot of people look to England and say, look, this is a place where there's doctors in the National Health Service hospitals and that practice homeopathy, and they must be defended. It just depends which way it goes. You see, when homeopathy was under threat, and complementary medicine in general was under threat, this idea of evidence-based, which was, as I say, unbelievably hypocritical, because it implies that orthodox medicine is all based on science, which I can't emphasize enough. It is simply not true that all orthodox medicine is based on science. And so to attack homeopathy with this, when it doesn't apply to orthodox medicine, is absolutely appalling. But they did have a what's called an early day motion. I mean, your listeners in the United States may not relate to these technical terms, but it's a vote in Parliament, as if it's a sort of desire in Parliament to talk about something. So, what they get is the MPs to sign a special document that says we want to talk about this, which means that they're concerned about it. So for that, out of the 600 members of the British Parliament, it's equivalent to Congress, okay, to say out of 600 congressional members, more than 200 signed this. So we know one out of three of the major politicians, the MPs, members of parliament in Britain, wants to stop this movement. One out of three, at least.
Hmm.
And that's quite a lot.
That's amazing. But, Brian, what can we do personally? I mean, obviously there are attacks happening in Great Britain. We don't see as much in the rest of Europe, continental Europe, the United States right now, but obviously this could portend for the future of the entire world.
That's a big one. I mean, you see, there's a difference in United States and here, and this is the difference that I see. It is Britain going in the direction where, at the moment, a sort of secular fundamentalism is extremely powerful, where everything is based on science, and anything that is not based on science is considered complete garbage, including religion and all sorts of things.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so this, in other words, if it's not apprehendable by the senses, if we cannot grasp this, okay, with our senses and mathematical knowledge or science, it is to be discarded. And that's so. This applies to all sorts of belief systems, religion, etc. Now, this is a bullying group of people who believe this, because the absolute majority of human beings on the planet believe in things that can't be seen. There's no question about it. In the States, for example, religious belief is much, much higher than here. So there is a danger of this concept of belittling the unseen. And what I'm saying is not that anything that homeopathy requires any religious belief system at all. There just is an element about homeopathy that the active ingredient at the moment is unseen. We do not know exactly what it is.
Right.
Now, some people have used this idea that it carries information. Okay? Yes, that may be so. But to compare it, as some have done, to a CD or a flash disk or something like that is wrong. Because the problem is that if you take a CD, a blank CD, and a CD with music on it, there is a way of distinguishing between the two, and that is to put them in one of them in a CD player. But if I give someone a 10 mL of CPR and a 10 mL of just a pill that's been medicated with just alcohol with no CPR, not so easy to differentiate. So this unseen element is what is being attacked here in a country that is moving against any belief in anything that is unseen, or not being comfortable living with the unknown, as it were. You see, think about it like this. If they do a survey, not of homeopathic remedies versus placebo, if they do a survey of the patients that have visited homeopathic hospitals in England, okay, and they say, we're going to talk to these patients and do a proper survey, ask them how satisfied they are, they're better, did it work, etc., the satisfaction index is incredibly high.
Right, right.
So now, what we're saying is that the patients that go to a homeopathic hospital, they have a homeopathic history taken, talking to the patient, etc., and then being given a homeopathic written. So they listen to, the homeopathic history is done, they're given a homeopathic remedy, they take the homeopathic remedy, they go home, and the overwhelming, over 90% are happy with and satisfied with the experience.
Sure.
That's the bottom line as far as I'm concerned. So these people say, when I've said this to some of my opponents here, they say, no, this involves lying to your patient, because if there's nothing in the pill and you're saying it, yeah, I'm going to give you this medicine, you lie. So I challenge Edzard Ernst. Edzard Ernst accused homeopaths of lying, because someone said, what does it matter? What does it matter? Maybe these doctors are just getting their patients better by talking to them and being nice to them and then giving them a pill and it's a placebo effect. But if the patient is getting better, then what's wrong with that? And he said, no, what's wrong with it is that they're lying, and we can't tolerate this lying. And then I wrote in the blog, lying? I've met homeopaths for 20 years I've encountered homeopaths. I've met them in Greece, in the United States, in Germany, in South Africa, all over the world. I've never, ever met someone that's lying. I've met people whose views I do not agree with, but I've never met someone that I thought was openly lying to his patients. How dare you criticize me of lying? I challenge you to a duel. Because that was a time-honored way of defending. Being called a liar in the 19th century was a slight.
Yeah, that's great.
So okay, so now they say they're lying. So now accused, someone else also said this. Colquhoun in a recent debate also said this. Professor Colquhoun, one of these people who wrote the famous, infamous letter to four doctors from sending patients to homeopathic hospitals.
Mm.
He also, I thought he accused them of lying, and he said, no, they're not lying, they're just deluded homeopaths. But nevertheless, these people cannot live with the fact that the patients are getting better. No one denies that. The patients that go to the homeopathic hospital are getting better.
Sure.
They just can't stand the fact that we doctors are attributing it to the homeopathy.
Right.
And
amazing.
To stop it is an act of unbelievable spite, because it's cost-effective medicine as well.
Yeah, of course.
And this guy called Dr. Spence in Bristol produced a brilliant study on general practice. It won the award at the Liga in Berlin, when they had the Liga met in Berlin, won the award as the best study, showing how cost-effective it is to use homeopathy in a general practice situation.
Sure, sure.
But they cannot stand it. I say they cannot stand it because to them, in their scientific minds, it is implausible. You see, it doesn't make sense to them. So therefore, they think, it doesn't make sense to me, I must destroy it. And that is just a terrible attitude.
It's interesting you should use that word, Brian, because there was a debate that was conducted by the University of Connecticut a few months back with people advocating for and against homeopathy.
Yeah.
Andre Sain was one of the advocates for homeopathy. And it was fascinating because one of the people who was actually not even a homeopath but who was advocating for homeopathy, his name was Dr. Roy in Material Science, he came on and he basically, his argument against the guy who was advocating against, the guy who was arguing against homeopathy, his argument was that it simply was not plausible. And the guy who was advocating for it came on and said, well, this is the first time I've heard of the law of plausibility.
Right, exactly.
It was hysterical because there is no such thing as a law of plausibility. So, it was just like...
Absolutely, I 100% agree with that attitude.
I
should say that the law of plausibility, exactly.
So Brian, you seem to be very well informed, and you've obviously, you've been delving and studying and practicing homeopathy for many years now. I'm curious, who were your influences in homeopathy?
Right. Just thinking at the homeopathic hospital. I got interested in the whole debate because when I was at the homeopathic hospital, it was the old homeopathic hospital, and I was in this wood-lined library that had been there for God knows how many years with all full of journals and everything. And I did get interested in the whole philosophical struggle that had gone on, Kent versus Hughes and all that. And I like the Kentian, the classical approach, although I felt some of the things were a bit over-religious in what was said. But I certainly moved to that sort of homeopathy early. And then George Vitulkas was a huge influence, no question. I went many times.
You actually went to stay with George in Greece?
Many times.
You did?
Many times, yeah, many times. And so I met, you know, people like Roger Morrison and the American people that have been influenced. Ananda Zirin, I like her attitude to homeopathy as well. And she was, obviously, I saw her many times in Greece as well.
Yeah,
and
for those people who are not aware, Ananda passed away recently.
Yeah, very sorry to hear that, yeah. I like her. I think her book, I know it's not many remedies, the core elements of the mental side of homeopathy or something like that, two volumes, I think those are brilliantly written, those books. And but George, I always respected George. I just like the clean way that he looks at a case, and maybe it's his engineering background and his dedication made a huge difference to me, definitely. Vasilis, his pupil, but again, from the stable, of George Vitulkas. And then over here there was a man, he died recently, he died in 2005, Dr. Eric Lederman, not so well known in homeopathic circles, but certainly practiced homeopathy since the 30s, and I met him in his 70s and he died in his 90s, but he had dedicated himself to psychotherapy, psychiatry, homeopathy. He was interested in dermatology as well. His whole life was medicine, but also philosophy of medicine. And he wrote a brilliant book called Philosophy and Medicine. And he just helped me grasp these things. You see, it's like he was a big influence because this subject, what we're talking about, what is it that remains in the homeopathic medicine? What is it that remains? You see, this whole concept of diluting things beyond Avogadro's number, that sort of stuff. And he helped me a lot because he said to me, Brian, what is the smallest element in the universe? What is the smallest division of matter? And what is it? I mean, do you know what it is? We can talk about atoms and nucleus of atoms and protons and photons and quarks. But as time goes by, they seem to break those up and we find even smaller things.
Sure.
And he said, the smallest division of the universe is unknowable.
Right,
and that helped me. You see, that helped me that it's not, that there may be something, you see, we may be something that we absolutely cannot measure now, but to say that because we cannot measure it, there is nothing, that is as stupid as saying to a patient who's in intense pain, we've done all the tests and there's nothing wrong with you.
Right. Yeah, that makes sense.
So he was a big influence.
Brian, what about some of the newer practitioners, people like Schulten and Sankaran, Mangialavori?
Again, I like Massimo particularly, Massimo Mangialavori. I just find I think he also absorbed George's teaching, started with George Vitulkas, as I did, and then just sort of devoted his life to study. And there's an intensity about the way these guys study. One guy that I also, he's a very good friend of Massimo and wrote the book on the spider remedies with him, is Hans Zwemke in Berlin. And he runs a course of homeopathy for doctors in Berlin, but he just keeps it very quiet. He brought out an undesire in there for many, many lectures and everything. And he just likes to play down his own name, but he's a fantastic homeopath, taught me an absolute fortune, and a big, big friend of Massimo. But these guys, you see, they got this incredible dedication to studying Materia Medica. I'll never forget being at Hans's house, and I saw a book about the ant, a big book, you know, 300 pages on ants. Why is he reading a book on ants? In order to understand the remedy for mica better, which is a remedy I might have used once in the last 25 years.
Sure.
So that sort of incredible dedication to studying Materia Medica is not my strength, huge knowledge of Materia Medica. I've argued you don't always need that.
Right.
And I mean, if I do need, you see, I'm able to phone him up and say, look, I've got a case, like the passage that you represent in my book. I'm one of the homeopaths who can phone up friends like Hans Wimke in Berlin and say, I've got a case, and he'll say to me, have you thought of crocus?
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, he's an influence.
So, Brian, what's in terms of your professional life as a homeopathic doctor, what would you say is the thing that's most had the biggest impact on you?
How do you mean? In homeopathy, in the sense of...
Yeah,
teachers?
What's the most important thing you've learned as a doctor of homeopathy?
Listen to people. You know, listen to people. In the end, what is the truth about life? Up to 25, we get stronger. Okay, we get stronger and bigger 25, up to 25. And after that, basically we're dying. We're getting less strong, okay? Yeah. Sorry to, upset any listeners that might be over than 25, but it is true. We're slowly going downhill. And the inevitability of it is death. There's no point in going into denial, okay? However, the quality of that time, the quality of coming to terms with that is very, very important. And homeopathy... It's just, I cannot say how deeply I appreciate what Heinemann and what the great homeopaths have had to say about how we listen to a patient.
Mm.
As I said earlier, it shows the utmost respect to listen to people like that. And the fact is that you have to listen to that in order to prescribe a remedy. If you said to doctors, just listen to your patient, it's good to listen to your patients, be more listening. What are they listening for?
Right.
You see, the tentativeness is made. You have to believe that the remedy is going to work, first of all, that the remedies work. Otherwise, you won't listen like that.
Right.
And then once you accept that homeopathic remedies do work, and every homeopath has seen something amazing that wouldn't have happened by a placebo result, once you accept that, then you understand that you have to listen in such a way that you will pick up something, or more importantly, better describe, is that you have to create an atmosphere in your consulting room into which the person feels drawn to give the most important information about themselves and to trust, to make yourself into the sort of being that they will trust with the most tender and vulnerable side of themselves.
Mm.
And to learn that is a lifetime's learning, but it's well worth doing.
Mm. Fantastic. Brian, earlier on, I introduced you as somebody who does something called provocative therapy, and I think you actually, in some of the literature you sent to me, you refer to it as homeopathic psychotherapy.
Yes, I have said that. I don't want to get into trouble by saying this is homeopathy.
Yeah, no, but that's okay. I think people understand you're applying that term because it has some similarity to homeopathy, but I'm just curious, what is provocative therapy and why do you call it homeopathic psychotherapy?
Okay, sure. Let me tell you a bit about the background of provocative therapy.
Okay.
First of all, it's as American as apple pie, okay?
Okay.
This was a guy called Frank Farrelly, who was my teacher, in the 1960s, was working at a place called Madison State Institute, Wisconsin. Madison State Institute, I think. It was an institute for mentally ill people in Madison, Wisconsin. Mendota State Institute was called. And he was using Rogerian standard counseling. When we talk about counseling, we're talking about the work of Carl Rogers, who I've emphasized in my book as a major person to study in terms of talking to patients. Big, big influence. Much more helpful than almost anyone else in psychotherapy. But he was doing this sort of work. And he was in the 91st interview with a schizophrenic patient who'd been an inmate for a long time. And for 92nd, and you can have 92 interviews because the person's there every day. And so he was doing this Rogerian work, and for no reason that he can remember, the patient said something. And Frank just suddenly said to him, which is not Rogerian therapy to do this, he said, "Okay, then, I agree with you. You'll never get out of here. You never are going to get well. I agree. You aren't going to get better." And as he said this, he's noticed a shift in the patient's physiognomy, the way he looked. He sort of didn't like this, sort of woke up. He said, "What do you mean?" He says, "Well, look, we've had 91, he sort of thought, let me take this a bit further. We've had 91 consultations, and I've come up with many ideas for you, and I've listened to you and everything. But ultimately, you have convinced me that there's no hope for you other than to remain on medication in this institution, and I give up. I basically agree with you." And the guy started to argue against this, saying, "No, it can't be. There must be a solution." "No, no, no, there's no solution to your problem. You're never getting out of here." So he played it, and this was born the first tool of provocative therapy, and that is, there's no to say there is no solution to your patient. Now, This guy did brilliantly well. Within 6 weeks, he was out of that institute and never returned, and was well managed and did very, very well. And so Frank started to build on this. And what happens if I encourage my patients to stay unwell almost, you see? And that's the homeopathic thing. Homeopathic would give a medicine that's capable of producing the symptoms. If you encourage your patients to do more of the same, of their crazy behavior, they tend to move in the opposite direction. However, there are some provisos to this process, and that is you do have to get permission. So you have to say to a patient, I say to my patients when I'm going to do this, do I have your permission to say things to you that are provocative, absurd, ridiculous, cheeky, homophobic, sexist, inane, offensive, blasphemous, and highly politically incorrect? Do I have permission to say those sort of things? And they all say, yes, yes, yes. Okay? And I'm smiling. Now, what the genius of Frank was, is he found that if you attack people's behavior with satire and make jokes about it, that could be cruel. But if at the same time you use your body language and your very presence to make it absolutely clear, and in order to do that you have to feel it, absolutely clear that I want to help you, I want you to succeed, I want you to do well. You project that with your body, but with your mouth and your brain, you tear apart their behavior. So they feel this double whammy coming at them. Their problem is being viciously attacked, and yet they feel deeply supported. He says, I think that someone said of Frank that this man is the kindest person she's ever met, wrapped up in the biggest son of a bitch she's ever met, you see. So this is the process, and this is very powerful, and it's just a couple of few sessions. And I reckon it's just homeopathic, because if you encourage an alcoholic not to drink, he's going to give you reasons of why he drinks. If you tell him to drink, which is like giving a homeopathic remedy, do more of the same, he's going to tell you, give him reasons to drink, he's going to tell you why he has to stop. And it's just, it really, people are provoked to find, locate the solution to their problems, articulate them in the interview, and finally enact them in their lives. And Heinemann, I can't remember the paragraph, chapter, and verse, but he talks about these difficult cases with psychological problems. They're not easy to just treat with Argentum nitricum or Lacus. They're not easy. And he talks about using a little bit of subterfuge, a little bit of trickery. And I think that provocative therapy fits the bill perfectly for that sort of stuff.
Hello?
Hello.
Hi, Brian. Sorry, my phone died.
Oh, okay. I hear you.
Sorry.
Anyway, I was talking about provocative therapy.
Did you finish with that last question? I'm sorry.
That was about the provocative therapy and how it...
Yeah, I'm so sorry about that. Okay. So, that sounds pretty incredible. I'm curious, do you use it in every case, every homeopathic case?
No. I don't inflict it on a homeopathic patient. So if a patient comes homeopathically...
Yeah.
And if I might mention it to someone, if I feel that the center of the case is very psychologically and they need to change a pattern. You don't just change people's psychological behavior so simply with homeopathic remedies. If a person needs something else, they often do, put it that way. So, but that's these people that have trusted me homeopathically and be helped with homeopathy, if I suggest something like that, they may come. But then there are others that have come just for the provocative therapy and asked me, to do this.
I see.
But as I say, even though I've studied homeopathy for 25 years, it's still a tool. I'm not the person that's nothing more than the person that uses the homeopathic tool. I'm a medical doctor. As you said, the different things that I use. I'll use a drug occasionally as well. I mean, it's
sure.
You know, it's just a wonderful tool. I hope that your listeners have heard me say that. I mean, it's an absolutely wonderful tool. But they select themselves for the provocative therapy. But I will say this: the connection between provocative therapy. Think about this: when they having provocative therapy, there's a certain amount of provocation that occurs, so that they're in this negotiating sort of process. Provocative therapy could be described as a sort of negotiation about your life and your health, as it were. Hmm. And when they're in this setup, you see them behave in a certain way under provocation, therapeutic provocation. Now that behavior that you see, I have found is very reliable if you use that in your homeopathic analysis, because that is the patient showing you who they are, as opposed to telling you who they are in the conventional history-taking.
Interesting. Brian, if people wanted more information about provocative therapy, where could they find out?
Have a look at, for the UK, provocativetherapy.co.uk is my site. Provocativetherapy.co.uk is the site of the British Institute of Provocative Therapy.
Okay.
And provocativetherapy.com is Frank Farrelly, the founder of Provocative Therapy's website in the States.
Okay. And what about information about your work, or do you have a website?
I have a site, yeah, www.drkaplan.co.uk.
Okay. So, and also just wanted to mention to people that Dr. Kaplan has written an excellent work in homeopathy titled The Homeopathic Conversation. We do sell that book, and if you want more information about it, you can call toll-free. The number is 866-599-5950. That's 866-599-5950. Dr. Kaplan, is there any other thing you want to share with the audience? Are you going to be traveling anyplace, going to any teaching any seminars?
I've got a seminar coming up Hungary coming up. But
okay,
I'd love to teach in the States more, but in Phoenix, the conference that you
at the National Center of Homeopathy Conference.
Yeah.
I remember seeing you there.
Yeah, and I enjoyed
that. Yeah, well,
we'd
love to get you to come to North America. So let me contact some people, some local schools and institutions, and see if somebody'd be interested. Because obviously you've been practicing for a long time. You have a lot of very valuable and useful information and wisdom to share with us. So
thank you.
Yeah. Well, this has been a very informative call. Let me unmute the lines and let some other people ask some questions as well. So thank you again, Dr. Kaplan, and I'll say goodbye one more time after we with some other
people. Sure, nice talking to you. Thanks.
Okay, hold on 1 second. Can everybody hear me?
Yes.
Good. Does anybody have any questions for Dr. Kaplan?
I do.
Go ahead, please.
This is Joy.
Hi, Joy.
You know, I'm really concerned about the direction of the health care in the United States. It looks like we're looking at universal health care. And I'm just wondering if there's anything that we can do to assure that bureaucrats are not determining the direction of our health care.
Well, it's very complex. You know, there's a very big difference in the way that Americans and British people look at health. I mean, British people sort of understand there's a national health service there. It's like a safety net. It's for everybody, and you will get some sort of medicine there. It may not be exactly what you want, and in many situations, not as high a standard as American medicine. But when I talk to people in America, they constantly have this fear. I think it should be a rubric in the repertory that says fear of losing health insurance. You see, the sort of, will I have health insurance? I'm changing state. Will I be able to still have health insurance, or will I just be in the gutter dying if I get ill, you see? So there's this a big fear factor to do with health and health insurance in the States. Obviously, the drug companies are enormously powerful. And as I was saying earlier in the interview, this whole notion that the orthodox medicine is fully evidence-based just simply isn't true. I mean, just have a look at my blog, the one I talk about, the pie that tells the truth about orthodox medicine. Have a look at the percentage of interventions in orthodox medicine that are not evidence-based. So the best chance, don't try, the idea of defending homeopathy and saying we've got trials and my cat got bit on homeopathy, which to me is convincing that animals respond to homeopathy, but it doesn't convince the powers that be, you see. The best bet is to ruthlessly attack those that spuriously and incorrectly imply or say that all of orthodox medicine is evidence-based. It is not evidence-based. Much of it is not evidence-based, including major money-making things like use of antidepressants and Ritalin in children, even things like angioplasty and the use of stents for coronary artery disease. There is minimal evidence for it. So
how do we get to your blog?
To my blog, just look at go to my site, or I can tell you. If you look at my website, drkaplan.co.uk, drkaplan.co.uk, mm-hmm. Well, I'll give you the thing for the blog as well. I'll find it. One second. Okay, Dr. Kaplan articles. That's Dr. Kaplan's. Dr. Kaplan. Dr. Kaplan. Articles. blogspot.com.
Thank you so much.
And we'll take anything that you want, you know, from that. But as I say, don't say homeopathy is scientifically evidence or compared to CDs or any of that. Counterattack. And the best counterattack is saying that orthodox medicine isn't evidence-based.
Right.
Most of it isn't evidence-based. Most of it. But and it's wrong. When they say that homeopathy should be chucked out because it's evidence-based, it's not evidence-based. That is incredibly hypocritical. That's a line I would take.
Great. Thank you so much.
Sure.
Great. Other questions for Dr. Kaplan?
Yes, I have a question.
Go ahead. What's your name, please?
Irene.
Hello, Irene.
Go ahead, Irene.
You mentioned Eric Lederman.
Yes.
And his books. How do you spell his name?
LederManN.
Okay. Thank you.
And I'll tell you, you can look on the internet. I mean, he's deceased now, but you can look on the internet at a site called Whole Person Medicine. WholePersonMedicine.co.uk, and that'll have all his books and plenty of his writing there as well.
Great, thanks.
Pleasure.
Great. Anybody else have a question for Dr. Kaplan? Don't be shy. This is your opportunity to learn from a master. Anybody else?
I've read his book. It's great.
Yeah, it is a great book for sure.
Thank you.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a very, very important work for contemporary homeopaths. Well, if we don't have any other questions, I think we'll end the call. Ryan, thank you so much again for joining us, and we really appreciate all your wisdom, all your clinical experience, all the wonderful information you have to share with us, and we hope to have you get back again for some future call.
Well, thank you so much. I mean, I really appreciate what you said about my book. I wrote it. You know, the people that when I wrote that book, it was rejected by quite a lot of publishers. And they said,
Is that right? Really?
Yeah. Oh, it was terrible. You know, I mean, I put that book on the shelf. I wrote it, and I wrote three quarters of it, and I showed it to people, and they said, "No, this is too personal. You need, if you're going to write a book on this, you must write a textbook."
Oh my God! I'm so surprised.
You know?
I recommend it to everybody.
And you know, and then. You know, the very things that the publishers were telling me that they said it, why they shouldn't publish it, were the very things that the people who read the book, they said they liked me talking about myself, the honesty of it. And I did say, I'm only writing like this in the hope that others will write like this as well and be honest about what has happened in consultation so that we all can learn from each other. So I'm delighted that people, that your listeners.
We feel you made a great contribution, so thank you so much.
Thank you. Thanks for having me on this program.
Okay, well, thank you. Everybody, can we say a big thank you for Dr. Kaplan?
Thank you.
Thank you. Nice talking to you all. Thanks for listening. Thanks for
bye-bye. Have a good rest of the week.